We come tonight then to continue our studies in the Savoy Declaration of Faith and Order of 1658. Not, as I keep reminding you, and as I hope you will agree, that we would become good Congregationalists, but much rather it gives us an opportunity to look in a structured manner at a number of the fundamental teachings of the Christian faith, and we come and examine these things not in the light of the teaching of the Declaration, but much rather in the light of the teaching of the Scriptures. And where we find that the Declaration agrees with the Scriptures, we say Amen. They agree with us. Wonderful. And where we find that what they say disagrees with the Scriptures, we say, well, they were men. Men make mistakes. They made a mistake here. So we'll reject it at that point, and we believe what the Scriptures teach. And we'd come to chapter 22, and not merely because chapter 22 covers just over two pages, at least in my copy of the Declaration, but also because the subject of chapter 22, of religious worship and the Sabbath day, is enormous. We decided to split them into two. And in fact, I think you would probably agree with me that after last week, we should really have split them into three. But we managed to deal, in sadly only a cursory fashion last week, with the subject of religious worship, and saw that the teaching of the Scriptures on this subject is very different from the teaching of the Declaration and of many other people indeed. And we saw that rather than being what we are doing now and what we do when we come into buildings like this on Sundays, we discover that that is not what the Bible says worship is. Much rather, the Bible teaches that worship is an attitude of heart which a Christian should have at all times. And that when people say, well, that means that in that case, what's the point of meeting together on a Sunday or a Tuesday or any other time with other members of the church? We saw that that's not an excuse for neglecting such things, but rather we are to meet together for apostolic doctrine, teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, and for prayer. And that's Acts 2:42, and we could see from other places that it's a right and proper thing to do to sing as well. So that's summary in about a minute of 47 minutes from last week. Tonight we're coming to look at the second half of the chapter of the Sabbath day. And the question is the teaching of the Declaration the teaching of the Scriptures? Well, again, the Declaration spells it out fairly clearly, but in somewhat archaic language, and rather than having to read half of this chapter, thankfully, the first seven chapters have to do... the first six chapters... I'll get it right in a minute. The first six paragraphs have to do with religious worship, the last two with the Sabbath day. So I'll quote these. As it is by the law of nature, that in general a proportion of time by God's appointment be set apart for the worship of God, so by his word in a positive, moral, and perpetual commandment, binding all men in all ages, he hath particularly appointed one day in seven for a Sabbath to be kept holy unto him, from which the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ was the last day of the week, and from the resurrection of Christ was changed into the first day of the week, which in Scripture is called the Lord's Day, and is to be continued to the end of the world as the Christian Sabbath, the observation of the last day of the week being abolished. The Sabbath is then kept holy unto the Lord, when men, after a due preparing of their hearts and ordering their common affairs beforehand, do not only observe an holy rest all the day from their own works, words and thoughts, about their worldly employments and recreations, but also are taken up the whole time in the public and private exercises of his worship, in the duties of necessity and mercy. So that's what the Declaration has to say concerning the Sabbath. And you'll find, if you go to the Westminster Confession, the 1689 Confession, the Baptist Confession, if you go to many other places, you read many books on the subject today, not just those published by the Lord's Day Observance Society, but there's, for example, in here, there is a chapter from a book that is shortly to be published by Walter Chantry. This is Banner of Truth magazine, October 1990. And there is a chapter entitled, Does the New Testament Teach the Fourth Commandment? And that's a chapter from this forthcoming book. And so it's something that is very commonly held, very commonly believed. The question is this teaching about the Sabbath the teaching of the Scriptures? Now, those of you that were here when we were looking at the law of God will have noticed that I kept referring to the Sabbath and saying, but we're going to be looking at that later. Because we looked at the law and we drew certain conclusions about the law, and we saw that what the Bible teaches about the law and its place, particularly with regard to us, was different from the Declaration. I'm sure many of you thought, well, if you're going to be consistent, that means you've got to do away with the Sabbath as well. Now, because of the nature of the Sabbath and because of the position many people take on it, I was very keen that we left that question there and we dealt with it tonight when we came to it. So we must be quite plain that the majority view with regard to the Sabbath is, as the Declaration has said, it's morally binding upon everybody. It's a perpetual commandment of God. And from the beginning, from the creation, to the time of the cross, it was a Saturday. And that from the time of the resurrection on until the return of Christ, it is a Sunday. And it's also referred to as the Lord's Day. And it's a day of rest from labour, and it's a day for worship. And so as a consequence of that, anything that is not necessary to be done on that Sunday should not be done. So shops should be closed, people should not work, they should not drive their cars, this is if they're consistent, should not fill up with petrol. There are many things they shouldn't do. The question is that the teaching of the Scriptures? That's a very commonly held view. What do the Scriptures teach? Well, let's begin at the beginning. It's one of the reasons I've given you this sheet. This sheet, let me direct you to this first of all, contains every reference I could find in Young's Concordance that has a bearing upon this subject. So we have in the Old Testament the words the Sabbath, and that are translated Sabbath, and then the New Testament, the words for Sabbath, and then the New Testament words translated as first day. I didn't bother with the Old Testament because it's not relevant in the Old Testament. And then in the whole of the Bible, words relating to the seventh day. Sometimes these are irrelevant, but I put them in anyway, like so-and-so did such-and-such 7 days later. And those obviously aren't relevant to the discussion about the Sabbath, but for completeness I put them in. And then I put down the one reference in the Scriptures for the Lord's Day. And that is, please note, the only reference to the Lord's Day in the whole of the Scriptures. And we're not going to do, as we didn't do last week, go through exhaustively and look up every reference, because you'd all be fast asleep by the time we'd finished. So we're going to look at those that I think are relevant, that give us teaching about the subject of the Sabbath, and try and let the Scriptures speak for themselves. So we begin at the beginning in Genesis. Genesis chapter 2. God has made the heavens and the earth in 6 days. He has looked upon his creation and seen that it was very good, because there was no sin. Everything was perfect. And then on the seventh day, verse 2 of chapter 2, God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. And people that hold to the Sabbath say this is the institution of the Sabbath. The Sabbath stems from creation. It's not something that was brought in at the time of Moses under the law. It is a creation ordinance. So therefore it's binding upon everybody. Now, without prejudging the issue, I would ask where it says here that this is a creation ordinance and where this is binding upon everybody. Because it doesn't say that. It tells us that God rested, and it tells us that God blessed the day. It does not tell us that God told Adam and Eve that they had to rest on the seventh day. Now, it's not prejudging the issue. That's just to note what those verses do and don't say. Because what we don't want to do is to insist upon something on no grounds at all. We want to insist on things on the basis that the Scriptures teach them. So those verses don't teach that the Sabbath is binding upon men. It merely tells us, and we'll see this emphasized later on, it merely tells us this was God's Sabbath, God rested, God blessed the Sabbath day. We then turn over to the next reference to the Sabbath in the Scriptures. We completely pass over the rest of Genesis, and we turn, not as many might think, to Exodus 20 and the Ten Commandments, but to Exodus chapter 16. And this is where God gives the children of Israel manna from heaven. And you may have that as a heading to the chapter in your Bible. But the verses we're going to look at are verses 22 to 30. So it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread. This is what they'd been commanded. We're not going to read the whole chapter, but it's in there. God says, you'll eat, you'll gather for 6 days. But the seventh day you won't gather, you'll gather twice as much on the sixth day. Verse 22, and so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. Then he said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, and boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. So they laid it up until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Then Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. The people rested on the seventh day. Now please note, and this will be confirmed if you read the whole of the chapter, the Israelites knew nothing about the Sabbath prior to this chapter. They were totally ignorant of it. As far as they were concerned, Saturday was just another day. But God gave them instruction in this chapter that this day was to be a Sabbath. And the word Sabbath means literally rest, cessation from work. So it was to be a day of rest for them, so they weren't to go out and collect food or do anything else. And notice what God says to them in verse 29, see, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. God has given it to you. Not that it was always existing. God has given it to you. This is something new. And this was then enshrined in the covenant that God made in Exodus chapter 20. You remember we saw when we were looking at the issue of the law, Exodus chapter 20 is the covenant that God made. It's not that the whole of the Pentateuch is the covenant, it's this chapter, the Ten Commandments, are the covenant that God made. And in Exodus 20, and verses 8 to 11, we have this: remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, nor shall your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. And just as a quick aside, if ever you meet those people who falsely call themselves Jehovah's Witnesses, they believe the days of creation were 1,000 years each. And this passage proves quite conclusively it's not. Because if it were 1,000 days, you'd have to read it thus. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6,000 years you shall labor and do all your work. You see, you laugh. It's silly. They believe it. This shows us quite clearly that the days of creation were days, periods of 24 hours. That's an aside. We'll get on to actually doing a study on the first 11 chapters of Genesis sometime in the next few years, and we'll look at that in more detail then. But this is where the Sabbath law was made law. It was binding upon the people. upon those who were in covenant with God. And those people who were in covenant with God were the Israelites, the Jewish nation. Now, some people make great play of the fact it says, remember the Sabbath day. And they say, that's referring back to creation. And I would say, well, it doesn't really say that at all. While it does refer to creation here, surely God is saying to them, I want you to keep the Sabbath. Not I want you to remember back to the beginning. I want you to remember the Sabbath. And he's reminding them of what he's instituted in chapter 16. But it's now here part of the law. And it's binding upon those in covenant with God, binding upon the Jews. And to see how binding it is, we've already seen from Exodus 31, as we read it, that those people who broke the Sabbath would be put to death. Exodus 31 verse 14, you shall keep the Sabbath, therefore it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. And if you turn over to Numbers chapter 15, we find that this is exactly the case. Numbers 15 and verse 32. Now while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. Then they put him under guard because it had not been explained what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, the man must surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So as the Lord commanded Moses, all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. Did you know there are people in this world, mainly in America, though there's at least one living in Bolton, who believe that the whole of the Mosaic Law is still in force, and we should reinstitute all the Mosaic Law as part of our civil law. And so we should reintroduce not just capital punishment for adultery, not just a ban on Marks and Spencer's jumpers that are made of polyester and cotton, but also anybody who does any work of any kind on a Sunday should be stoned to death. There are people that believe that today. And I would say they are being quite consistent. If they hold that the Sabbath law is still in force, then not merely the commands on what we should do, but the penalties must surely still apply. And I think the fact that they don't insist upon that shows that they are being inconsistent. But then we need to ask ourselves why the Sabbath was given to the Israelites. And we read this back in Exodus 31. Exodus 31 and verse 13. Speak to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Turn over to Ezekiel. Ezekiel and chapter 20. And verse 12. Moreover, I also gave them, and notice, this is what I was saying earlier, God gave to the Israelites. Moreover, I also gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between them and me, that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. So you see, the Lord gave the Sabbath to Israel to be a sign to them about what God was doing in their midst. If you turn back to Nehemiah, chapter 9, verse 13. You came down also on Mount Sinai and spoke with them from heaven and gave them just ordinances and true laws, good statutes and commandments. You made known to them your holy Sabbath and commanded them precepts, statutes and laws by the hand of Moses, your servant. So once again, In this prayer of Ezra, we read that God gave his Sabbath to the Israelites. They didn't have it before God gave it to them in Exodus 16. It's something that was unknown from Genesis 2 to Exodus 16. It was something new that God gave to them, but didn't give to anybody else. Nobody else at all. And that's the reason why you will look in vain throughout the scriptures to find any other nation castigated for failing to keep the Sabbath. Now you read quite a lot about judgment on Egypt, Edom, Assyria, Babylon, and others. But not once do you find the charge laid at their door that they failed to keep the Sabbath. And the reason for that is not because they kept the Sabbath. They completely ignored the Sabbath because they ignored the God of Israel. And this shows us even more the contention I'm making. God gave his Sabbath to the Israelites, but to nobody else, in the same way he gave his law to the Israelites and to nobody else. Well, I want to pick up a bit more on the significance of the Sabbath, because it will help us to understand more its place within the law. And to do this, we need to look at something else first. Turn back to Genesis chapter 9. Noah has just left the ark at the end of the flood. Noah is offering sacrifices to God. And God makes a promise, God makes a covenant with Noah and with all Noah's descendants, which means with us as well. And what do we find that God says to Noah in Genesis 9 and verse 12 and following? Verse 11, I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. God made a covenant with Noah and his descendants, and God gave a sign. Every time you see a rainbow, you should remember this. And it's a promise from God. Never again will the earth be destroyed by a flood. Localities may be destroyed by a flood, but not the earth. God's given us a sign to remind us and him of the covenant that was made. Turn over to Genesis 17, about Abraham. Genesis 17, and God makes a covenant with Abraham, a very solemn covenant. Someday I must go through this chapter and explain to you the significance and the symbolism that's contained in this chapter. But we read here in verse 4, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of many nations. So God makes a covenant with Abraham. Verse 7, I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. And then in verse 11, we'll read from verse 10, so as not to break into a sentence. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. Now these two verses are interesting because God says in verse 10, this is the covenant, circumcision. But in verse 11 he says it's the sign of the covenant. Circumcision wasn't the covenant itself, of course. Circumcision was the sign But so intimately connected with the covenant itself was the sign that God could say, circumcision is the covenant. Okay, if you've got that, when we turn over to Exodus 31, which we've already read, the place of the Sabbath in the covenant with Israel should become clear. Verse 13 of Exodus 31, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep. It is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. And if we see that that is the sign of the covenant, and we've seen with regard to circumcision that circumcision is the covenant because that's what it signifies, we can almost say that the Sabbath is the covenant that God made with Israel. And that is why breaking the covenant, breaking the Sabbath, was such a dreadful thing. It was cocking a snook at God and saying, not interested in your covenant. That's what breaking the Sabbath meant. Telling God where to go, where he could get off. And that's why the penalty for Sabbath breaking was so severe. Because this was the sign of the whole covenant. The covenant was wrapped up in this. But remember, this was only given to Israel. So now we can see, if you remember when we were dealing with the law, I made the distinction between absolute moral law and covenantal law. And I pointed out that the Ten Commandments were the covenant that God made. And I pointed out also that in Hebrews 8:13, amongst other places, the writer there says, the covenant is obsolete and done away with. So the Ten Commandments are now gone. And that includes the Sabbath as the sign of the covenant. You remember I said that does not mean that we can live immoral lives. Because 9 of those 10 commandments are absolute moral law. We are still bound to keep them because they are eternally binding. But the Sabbath is not eternally binding because it is only binding upon those who were in covenant with God under the Mosaic law. And because the covenant has gone, the sign of the covenant has gone. You say, oh, I'm not sure about this. I've been reading in the Banner of Truth magazine. I've been reading this article, Does the New Testament Teach the Fourth Commandment? I'm looking forward to this book that he's publishing soon called Call the Sabbath a Delight. And I see in here that the Fourth Commandment, he shows quite clearly that the New Testament teaches the Fourth Commandment is a continuing obligation. Well, if you care to read this, you'll find that all he does in contradicting what I'm saying is to call me rude names. He doesn't take up any of the points I've made thus far, let alone the ones I'm going to come on to make. So let's now come on to the New Testament, and let's do a bit more with the New Testament than is done in this article. Because this article looks at the Gospels, but it doesn't go beyond the Gospels. We won't do it, but if you look through those references on those sheets I've given you from the Gospels, you'll find it's very plain that every reference to the Sabbath in the Gospels is to the Jewish Sabbath, to the Saturday. Walter Chantrey makes great play of Matthew chapter 12 and verse 8, which is the only Gospel reference we'll actually refer to. Because we read this. This is where they were going through the cornfields on the Sabbath day. And we read in Matthew 12 and verse 8, after the Pharisees have been castigating Jesus, he points out, verse 5, have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? He's trying to show they've completely misunderstood the nature of the commandment. I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. In verse 8 he says, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. See, the Pharisees had made the Sabbath their God. And Jesus was saying he's Lord over the Sabbath. He's not under the Sabbath, he's over it. And he's the one that determines whether or not certain things are right and wrong. Not them. And so he says, no, this is perfectly legitimate. This is allowed. Even under the law. And remember, when Jesus was on earth, he was under the law. The law had not been done away with until he died. And that's why we keep reading about Jesus keeping the Sabbath. And this is where Walter Chantry makes his big mistake. He fails to see that the law is up until the death of Christ. So Jesus is still living in the Old Testament. The New Testament doesn't begin until he rises from the dead. Well, what about Acts? Well, we won't look up every reference, but let's just look at a few. Acts chapter 13. Well, perhaps we will look at them all. There's only four. Acts chapter 13 and verse 14. But when they departed from Perga and came to Antioch in Pisidia, they went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. Now, was the Sabbath day a Sunday? Well, if it was, they would have been nobody else in the synagogue. They went to the synagogue on the day when they would find Jews there. The Sabbath day, a Saturday. Acts chapter 13, verse 42. And when the Jews went out of the synagogue, the Gentiles begged that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. Again, in the synagogue on the Sabbath day, the Saturday, when the Jews assembled. Verse 44. And the next Sabbath, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God. Again, it was the day on which the Jews met in the synagogue. Chapter 15. We find exactly the same. Verse 21. For Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city being read in the synagogues every Sunday, every Saturday, every Sabbath. Acts chapter 16, verse 13. And on the Sabbath day we went out of the city to the riverside where prayer was customarily made. And sat down and spoke to the women who met there. He said, ah, it's not a synagogue, so perhaps here it means a Sunday. I would say, no, perhaps there wasn't a synagogue in the city. And perhaps what they did, they thought, right, where will we find the Jews on the Sabbath, on a Saturday? There must be a place of prayer. Let's go and look down by the river. And they met a group of women there praying. And hence they met Lydia, and Lydia was converted. So still, the Sabbath is a Saturday. Acts chapter 17 and verse 2. Then Paul, as his custom was, as we've seen, went into them, and for three Sabbaths, this is the synagogue, you can see from verse 1, and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the scriptures. Again, it was a Saturday, it wasn't a Sunday. The word Sabbath throughout Acts means Saturday, not a Sunday. Acts chapter 18 and verse 4. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. Now, if he'd have been there on a Sunday, he would have persuaded no one because he'd have been the only one there. But the Sabbath was a Saturday and he was there with a vast crowd of Jews. And so they were able to hear him and listen to him. So the evidence is not what the declaration contends, that the day has changed, but the Sabbath been preserved. There is no evidence of that anywhere in the scriptures. This is the contention of modern day Sabbatarians. The Sabbath has been preserved. Only the day has been changed. There is not a single reference anywhere in the scriptures to support that contention. The way they argue is this. Jesus rose on the on a Sunday. Jesus met his disciples on a Sunday. The early church met on a Sunday. And the reason they met on a Sunday was because the day had been changed. And I would say not at all. The day hasn't been changed. The Sabbath hasn't been preserved. The Sabbath's been done away with. And the reason they met on a Sunday was, one, because Jesus rose from the dead, and two, because they wanted to distinguish themselves from the Jews. We'll come on to that a bit more in a moment. Rather, we find support for my contention, Colossians chapter 2 and verse 16, that the Sabbath has been abolished. Colossians 2 and verse 16, "Therefore let no one judge you in food or in drink or regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths, which are a substance of things to come, but the substance, sorry, a shadow of things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ." Now people read this and they see their problem. Sabbatarians don't like this verse. Neither do they like Romans chapter 14, which says essentially the same sort of thing. Romans 14 verses 5 and 6. "One person esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. He who observes the day observes it to the Lord. And he who does not observe the day, to the Lord he does not observe it." Ah, come back to Sabbatarians. This is talking about special Sabbaths apart from the weekly Sabbath. Well, I don't know what Bibles they use, but that's not what it says in mine. It's blanket. It's complete. One man esteems one day better than another, Saturday. Another man esteems all days alike. Let every man be convinced in his own mind. None of you are right or wrong. Colossians says these are a shadow which are now done away with. The substance is Christ. They're all pointing forward to Christ. So as with the law, Hebrews 8:13, it's obsolete and done away. The Sabbath is obsolete, part of the law, and is done away. The law is gone, and the sign is gone. Now, Sabbatarians still try and hold their position by referring to Hebrews 4. In Hebrews 4, we read about a Sabbath rest. And it says in Hebrews 4 about the seventh day, verse 4, "For he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again, in this place they shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains that some must enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter it because of disobedience, again he designates a certain day, saying in David, 'Today, after such a long time, as it has been said, today do not harden your hearts. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts.' For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterwards have spoken of another day. There therefore remains a rest for the people of God." And if you buy John Owen's commentary on Hebrews, and if you're an insomniac, it's probably an excellent commentary to get, all seven volumes of it, you'll find a whole section on this passage in which he attempts to defend the traditional view of the Sabbath. And he does it extremely unsuccessfully, because this passage is not talking about the perpetuity of the Sabbath. It is saying that believers have a rest in two senses. We rest from sin when we're converted, and we have an eternal rest to look forward to when we die. And that's all the passage is saying. And it's not telling us anything about the weekly Sabbath. It's saying that God's eternal Sabbath will be applied to us. And we see, back in Romans 14, that the teaching of the New Testament, now that it's gone from being one nation on earth to a spiritual nation worldwide, that the rules and regulations that God has given us, the principles that we have, are much more practical. If we were trying to keep the Sabbath as the Jews should have done, and if this was applied blanket to all the countries in the world, we wouldn't have any cars. Not because we wouldn't be able to fill up with petrol on a Sunday, but because there would not be the metal available to make them with. Because you would have to shut down the blast furnaces on a Sunday at the steelworks. Because there'd be no excuse for keeping them going. And you can't shut a blast furnace down once a week. It's not practical. So there'd be no steel. And if you've got no steel, where's the cars? What are the cars going to be made of? And you start thinking in those terms. We'd be living in a vastly different society from the one that we're living in at the moment. It would not be practical to do anything. If we were consistent Sabbatarians, we would be lighting this building tonight with candles. Because this heating system and this lighting system is dependent upon people in power stations and distribution stations making sure that the electricity gets to us. You can't go off and leave a power station for a Sunday. It's not possible. It's not practical. The whole of society would be different. think back to the early days of the church. Many of the people who were converted were slaves. Can you imagine that come Sunday, the slave would say to his master, "Well, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to sweep the floor today. I'm not going to give you your dinner today. It's Sunday today. I'm a Sabbatarian. It's my day off." And the master would have said, "I beg your pardon. You're my slave. You'll do as you're told. And if you won't do as you're told, then you're dead." And we read of a lot of slaves in the New Testament being members of churches. We don't read of wholesale slaughter. You don't find in the history of the early church, after the New Testament was written, that they were having this problem. Rather, what you find is the church had its meeting in the evenings and at night. Remember last week we looked in Acts chapter 20, Paul at Troas with the church. 21:7, on the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul raised the bar the next day, spoke to them, and continued his message until midnight. He didn't start preaching at 11 o'clock in the morning at their morning meeting. The people were working during the day. Paul was practical. He said, "Right, you're at work during the day. In the evening we'll meet and then I'll preach to you." The scriptures are practical. Not as the Sabbatarians would have it, but that's the way it is in the New Testament. Now I've got to hurry because I've only got about 2 minutes left. So then, what of Sunday? Well, you'll see from Romans 14, we have liberty. If you want to be Sabbatarian, be Sabbatarian. I don't mind. But don't impose your Sabbatarianism on other people. They have the liberty to treat the day entirely as they choose. But for those of you who aren't Sabbatarians, don't ridicule and mock and offend those who are Sabbatarians. So what do we make of Sunday? Well, you'll see on the sheet there's the one reference to the Lord's Day. Revelation chapter 1 verse 10. John says, "I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day." It's always been assumed that that's a Sunday. It probably was. There's no evidence to that. None at all. It might have been Easter Sunday. We don't know. You cannot prove that biblically. I'm prepared to accept it, though. It probably was a Sunday. Because Jesus rose. We have the practice of the early church that they met on a Sunday. And it shows the break from Judaism and freedom from the law. So therefore I think we should follow apostolic practice and meet on a Sunday. Though if we were in Saudi Arabia, I'd suggest we meet on a Friday, because that's the day off in Saudi Arabia. The New Testament's practical. You can take Christianity anywhere without any problems. We should take opportunity to have fellowship at any time, but particularly at those times that are convenient. In this country, Sunday is convenient. Let's always meet together on a Sunday. Acts 2, 46 and 47, we read about that. Hebrews 10, chapter 10, verses 23 to 25. Let's not neglect meeting together with one another. The biblical principle I think we can draw from the Sabbath, I think, is stated in Mark 2, 27. Where Jesus, speaking to his disciples and in response to the Pharisees, Mark 2:27, he says this: "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." The whole function of the Sabbath wasn't to be a god over everyone. It was for their benefit. And it teaches us that God has made the human race in such a way we need one day's rest in seven. Now, if you want to make that Saturday, fine. The way I live, Saturday is my day of rest. Sunday is very much a working day for me. But we need, from those principles, a day's rest a week. Think of what it'd be like if you had to work 3 weeks straight through. Horrible. You'd want a rest once a week. So that's the principle you can draw. One day's rest in seven. But what then do we say of Sunday trading? Is it right or is it wrong? And I would say in this country, in England, it's wrong because it breaks the law. It's not the people who go shopping on a Sunday, it's the traders who are breaking the law. They're breaking the Shops Act of 1950. And I'm quite content if the government wants to legalise Sunday trading. although I've written to my MP on many occasions and said, I've got no theological objections, but I would want to insist that the workers are given freedom to have one day's rest a week. And those who have grounds of conscience or whatever, if they want Sunday off, they're entitled to have Sunday off if they so choose. And I think that's the only way, biblically, we can regard it. We cannot say, the Bible says you've got to close on a Sunday, because it doesn't. It doesn't say that at all. Unless we want to go back and say capital punishment for you if you break the Sabbath. No Marks and Spencer's polyester and cotton shirts, jumpers or whatever. Let's be consistent. If the law's gone, it's gone, including the Sabbath. But let's not abuse the freedom that we've got. Let's use it well. Let's have the rest that we need. Let's meet together for encouragement, for apostolic doctrine, for teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, prayer, singing God's praises. And let's not abuse those who disagree with the position we might take. If you're a Sabbatarian here tonight, perhaps you feel you've been hammered. Well, I'm sorry if you feel that. That's not my intention. And I'll still have fellowship with you, even though you disagree and think that I'm wrong. Because there are far more important things in this world.